University of Montana President Royce Engstrom gives his mid-year report to the UM campus. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capitol reporter Dan Voice looks at how much expanding Medicaid to low-income Montanans would cost the state. And in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock talks with NPR reporter Nathan Rott about his coverage of Montana's wolf controversy. Before we get to our top story, we have this breaking news. The University of Montana and Missoula police late this afternoon issued an alert that a Bozeman rape suspect, Kevin Briggs, might be in Missoula. Bozeman police say Briggs is a suspect in a weekend assault and rape case. He's described as 28 years old, 5 feet 5 inches tall, weighing 150 pounds with brown hair and blue eyes. He's reported to have been on probation and of being convicted of kidnapping and raping a girl in Helena in 2003. If you have information about Briggs, please call 911 or call campus police at 243-4000. University of Montana President Royce Engstrom presented his mid-year report to the campus community this afternoon. UM's Chief Communications Officer, Peggy Kerr, says Engstrom's presentation was meant to outline some of the challenges and indications of progress at the school. UM's nearly $6 million budget deficit certainly ranks as a challenge, and funding is directly tied to enrollment. Kerr says UM will continue to work on improving enrollment,
which runs the gamut from looking at how we offer scholarships and other sources of funding to students wanting to come here, how we increase the amount of money we can give students, how we recruit more students, and how we touch more prospective students more frequently and, frankly, with better recruiting materials.
In the meantime, UM has implemented what administrators are calling a hiring chill, meaning most vacant staff positions will not be filled, tenured faculty will be asked to teach more, and reliance on adjunct faculty will decrease. Kerr says not all the news is bleak.
With the University of Montana Foundation, last fiscal year, the foundation raised a total of $17.5 million. This year, as of right now, we have surpassed $20 million in private support. I think one of the reasons is we're just, again, looking at opportunities. We are looking at what our donors are interested in, and among that is student success. And there is a concerted effort in the area of research monies and scholarship for both graduate and undergraduate students, and I think that's resonating in a tremendous way with donors.
She says Engstrom also was eager to discuss a number of ongoing building projects.
Missoula College, of course, that's in the environmental assessment stage. We have a number of other buildings that are coming online in the next year to 2 years, from that Student Athletic Academic Center to the Gilkey Center for Entrepreneurship.
Kerr says Engstrom is asking UM educators to focus on interdisciplinary, international, and online educational opportunities.
And in other news from around the state, the Montana Supreme Court says a legislative referendum to end Election Day voter registration can go on the 2014 ballot. But the justices ruled in a 5-1 decision today the Attorney General's office must first revise the ballot statement to clarify that the change is not required by the federal National Voter Registration Act. Montana has allowed voters to register or change their registrations on Election Day since 2005. The referendum approved by the 2013 Republican-led legislature for the November ballot would change the deadline to registration to the Friday before an election. Seven unions and interest groups filed the petition with the Supreme Court to remove the referendum from the November election. They say the measure's reference to the federal voting law is misleading and could cause voter confusion.
Analysis of a new ballot measure seeking to expand Medicaid predicts the proposal would eventually cost the state more than $23 million a year. State lawmakers in 2013 voted against expanding the government-run health insurance program for the poor, which is an optional piece of the Affordable Care Act. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce says supporters of the so-called Healthy Montana Initiative hope to put that option before voters in November.
Latest estimates say more than 80,000 Montanans would receive health insurance coverage under Medicaid expansion. Essentially, a whole new subset of the population would become eligible for the program that is not eligible now, specifically low-income adults, between the ages of 19 and 64 who are not disabled, not pregnant, and don't have children. Governor Steve Bullock supports expansion. His budget director, Dan Villa, says providing insurance to that group could result in fewer unpaid emergency room visits in the future.
Folks just running into the emergency room because they don't have health insurance, and those costs that are absorbed by the remainder of the insured population would no longer be spread.
Expansion also includes new federal funding for prison inmates' health care, for mental health services, and for treating chemical dependency.
If we treat the source of that incarceration, recidivism rates and the likelihood to offend in the future goes substantially down. Well, now instead of state taxpayers paying for that, we're able to bill the federal government for those costs.
Or that would be the case with expansion. Supporters put together the Healthy Montana Initiative after Republican majorities in the state legislature killed the proposal last year. It would allow voters to initiate Medicaid expansion, provided the legislature approves the state funding for it, because the state will have to pay. Backers often tout the federal government as paying for the total cost of expansion for the first 3 years. That's true, but the clock on that already started ticking at the beginning of this year. The Healthy Montana Initiative would not kick in until halfway through that higher federal funding level. So in the first 4 years of expansion, the net cost to the state's general fund would only be a little more than $2 million. Villa says that $2 million would unleash hundreds of millions of federal dollars every year.
That would otherwise go to California, New York, New Jersey, that would now return back to Montana, the taxes that the state citizens have paid to the federal government.
But the state's share gradually increases to 10% of the cost of expansion in 2020. That's expected to be more than $23 million of the state's annual budget. Stevensville Republican Senator Fred Thomas voted against expansion in 2013. He looks at that annual cost and says, look, the public also wants to adequately fund other programs like K-12 education and the university system.
And they want roads and cops taking care of things as well. And this expansion of Obamacare cuts into all those things because it'll grow and the cost will grow and grow.
The Affordable Care Act says states will never pay more than 10% of the cost of expansion. Opponents argue the federal government could change its mind in the future. Senator Thomas points out the state pays a full third of the cost for current Medicaid enrollees, and he thinks that would eventually happen with this new expansion population.
That is a huge cost to the state and the taxpayers of this state that they need to really weigh that out and say, do we want to commit to that, not knowing where this thing is going?
The Healthy Montana Initiative contains within it a provision preventing these kinds of future cost hikes for the state government. Again, Governor Bullock's budget director, Dan Villa.
If the federal government ever changes the match rates, then the state automatically opts out.
That stipulation, though, still does not convince Senator Thomas.
Once you trigger this and you're into this program, it's my opinion that one way or another, you're into it. You don't take benefits back. And that's just a reality in life.
Supporters of the Healthy Montana Initiative will begin gathering signatures within a few weeks if the Attorney General's office approves it. More than 24,000 Montanans will have to sign the petition in order to place it on the November ballot. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
A Montana judge has scheduled a two-day competency hearing to determine if a Colorado man charged with the killing of a high school teacher is fit for trial. District Judge Richard Simonton scheduled the hearing in the case of Michael Keith Spell for March 24th and 25th in Sydney. The 24-year-old defendant from Parachute, Colorado, was charged with killing Sydney High School teacher Sherry Arnold while attempting to abduct her on January 7th, 2012. Spell's attorneys say he suffers from mental disabilities that render him unable to understand the case against him or assist in his defense. Prosecutors have said they intend to seek the death penalty. Co-defendant Lester Van Waters Jr. pleaded guilty in the case last year under a deal with prosecutors. He is awaiting sentencing.
A school in southwestern Montana is moving its basketball practices and this week's game after a student who brought guns to school last year and is charged with making more threats was released to the custody of his parents. Harrison Superintendent Fred Hoffman said yesterday the school would move its practices and Friday's homecoming game against Sheridan to Willow Creek, which is just over 25 miles away. Harrison and Willow Creek students play on the same basketball and volleyball teams. The boy was arrested in January of last year after bringing guns to school. He reached a plea agreement in May that called for treatment and probation. Hoffman says the 15-year-old boy was recently charged with a felony for telling another student that he planned to go through with the shootings and blow up the school.
Ravette Minerals Incorporated says it has found enough silver and copper reserves to extend the life of a northwestern Montana mine to 12 years. Work at the Troy mine came to a halt in December 2012 after a series of rock falls and cave-ins. The mine laid off 100 workers in May, leaving about 65 employees. Currently, 56 employees are working to construct a new tunnel. The route was approved by the Mine Safety Health Administration in November. Ravette spokeswoman Monique Hayes told the Missoulian yesterday the company expects to resume limited mining operations later this year, with full production resuming in the first half of 2015. Hayes says the number of employees could double by the end of the year as production resumes.
BNSF plans to invest $5 billion in its railroad this year, including $900 million to expand capacity in the Northern Plains, where crude oil shipments are surging. The railroad said yesterday its 2014 spending plan is roughly $1 billion higher than last year. BNSF says it's responding to significant volume growth. Some projects should help alleviate congestion near the booming Bakken oil field in North Dakota and Montana. Last year, the National Association of Railroad Passengers complained to officials that the growth in oil shipments was disrupting Amtrak passenger service. In addition to expanding capacity, BNSF plans to spend $2.3 billion maintaining its network and $1.6 billion on locomotives and equipment. BNSF is based in Fort Worth, Texas, but it is owned by Omaha, Nebraska-based conglomerate Berkshire Hathaway, Inc.
Growing up in Montana, Nathan Rott knew wolves were controversial. Now, the University of Montana journalism grad is reporting on that controversy for National Public Radio. Rott and photographer David Gilkey recently spent several weeks in Montana and Yellowstone National Park meeting with wolf lovers, wolf haters, and wolf scientists. The result is an in-depth report aired on NPR along with an audio slideshow. In tonight's feature interview, Rott talks with news director Sally Mock about the story and about his own memory of the wolf debate while growing up in Missoula.
I do. I mean, I remember, it's hard to grow up in Montana and not remember seeing it on the newspaper every single, you know, every time there's any sort of wolf news, it's usually a front page story on the Missoulian or the Bozeman Chronicle or you name it. I remember it being a very controversial thing. I remember my parents talking about it to some extent. And yeah, just kind of a fascinating thing as a kid to sort of observe.
And when did you personally first view a wolf? Was it before you did this story?
Actually, yeah. I worked as a wildland firefighter for a number of years up in Marion, Montana, outside of Kalispell. And it's a really cool experience. I was driving in the fire engine with one of my coworkers, and we stumbled upon a pack of actually really young wolves. I don't know if you'd call them pups, but they definitely weren't coyotes, and it was incredible. It was really neat to see them.
And then the next time you saw them was, I assume, when you came back to do this story about the wolves in Montana and in Yellowstone.
You know, I spent a lot of time in the outdoors in Montana, and I've heard wolves howl, but I've never, other than that one time with the fire crew, I'd never seen one in the wild until going up there and doing this story and going into Yellowstone with people that are professionals. I mean, this is what they do, is track wolves and see where they go and bring people to them. And we were pretty fortunate in that we had what they said was a very good wolf viewing experience. I know our photographer, David Gilkey, he was a little blue in the face when he realized that 2 miles out was a good viewing, because it's pretty hard to get a picture from of a wolf from 2 miles out.
But he did get some fantastic photos. I'm glad you brought up the photographer, David Gilkey, because the program you've done for NPR has just a fantastic slideshow, and he got some great photos, one especially of a couple of wolves that looks like they're playing with each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we spent a lot of time tromping around in Yellowstone looking for wolves. We actually saw one cross the road in front of us, and I mean, anybody that's been to Yellowstone kind of knows that when a wolf is spotted, it quickly becomes almost a circus on the road of everybody stopping and pulling over and doing all that, and spooked the wolf off pretty fast. He's from Oregon, and so he kind of knows the type of people that live in kind of rural areas and everything, which is great because, I don't know, there's sometimes a disconnect between people when they come out to places like Montana and have to sleep in a hunting camp for a night or something like that. And yeah, he's one of our war photographers, so he's well-versed in the ways of roughing it.
There's a point in the program where you quote Ed Bangs, who's the former federal wolf recovery coordinator, and he says, quote, "The debate about wolves is not really about wolves at all."
And it was really refreshing to hear somebody say it. A lot of people kind of hint about it, and I think everybody kind of knows it, but very few people are willing to just say it, especially when you're talking to people that are actively involved in it, because it doesn't do their argument any justice when you kind of put it in that way. But when you boil it down, there's, you know, it's urban versus rural, it's federal government versus state rights, it's agriculture versus tourism. So it's kind of a changing economy in Montana that gets fought out on the back of a wolf. I mean, it's pretty interesting. And there's some people I talked to that even said, to a certain extent, it's even red blue.
The culture war, you say in the program, that it's really part of the culture war.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, it's people's values. Ed, this cut of tape didn't make the actual story or Ed's quote. But he said, you know, if you were to walk into a bar in Montana and say, "I blank wolves, love, hate, whatever," you're A, going to get a pretty big reaction probably from people, and B, whoever, you can probably make assumptions about the person based on what they said. So if you say, "I love wolves," then he said, it's kind of sad, but it's true that you can make assumptions about the person and the way they view the world that would probably hold up. And the same is true of the other side, you know, the kind of values that the person has in all aspects of their life.
And the passion on both sides is so deep, which your story really shows. And one example of many that you could use, but one is of a rancher who shot a wolf that had killed some of his livestock, and it was illegal kill for him to do this, but the wolf turned out to be one of Yellowstone's most famous wolves, the wolf called Daddy's Girl. And then it was posted on Facebook, and he got death threats. He and his wife got death threats.
Bill Hoppe, the fellow you're mentioning, is an interesting character. He does not like wolves. I mean, one of the first times I met with him, he was wearing a hat with a wolf in the crosshairs on it.
I've seen many of those hats around Montana.
Yeah. Yeah. Bill Hoppe's kind of in the middle of this in a lot of ways because he is outspoken in his dislike about wolves, and then he had some livestock killed by wolves. There are people that like wolves that claim that he, that allege, I should say, that he put those sheep there on purpose and did so that he could bait a wolf in to kill. I talked to all of the Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, the Wildlife Services people that investigated the actual incident, and they all said that, you know, he did nothing that was illegal. He did everything by the books. Whether or not you want to disagree with him putting his sheep there is that's a matter of opinion, I guess.
Given this kind of passion on both sides and the fact that it really is part of the culture war, Nate, did you come away after doing the story of thinking there's any common ground to be reached? Of course, your story does point out there are some ranchers who are trying to protect their livestock without killing wolves, coming up with new techniques, doing flagging along their fence line and so on. But did you come away thinking that there's a middle ground possible anywhere?
I did, entirely. I mean, so I guess the first way to answer that is I think the issue of wolves is always going to be a big, passionate, value-laden issue just because it is that. It's values and those, you know, not everybody is ever going to see eye to eye on everything. That's just human beings. But I'm doing it. There's another story actually that's going to air this weekend that is about people that are completely in the middle, people that are trying to compromise. You've got a lot of really neat efforts that are going on in Montana and in the Northern Rockies about people that are kind of trying to find a way to bridge that gap that we're talking about. The Blackfoot Challenge, for example, up in Ovando, they're doing all sorts of really interesting things with, they have a range rider program where it's almost like a modern day shepherd, somebody that goes out with cattle and kind of tracks and monitors where wolves are going and lets ranchers know about that so that they can kind of try to mitigate any sort of encounters and or depredations. And that's just one of a lot of things they got going there. And you have people in the Tom Minor Basin and north of Yellowstone National Park that are doing the same. And you've got people that were really outspoken at one point on one side of the issue or the other. Bruce Malcolm was a former state legislator, and he lives in the Paradise Valley. Not a big fan of wolves, but when I talked to him, he kind of said, you know, at some point, he accepts that wolves are here. they're never going to get rid of them. And so he says, at some point, you don't want to die angry. So it doesn't do you any good to have your blood pressure all the way up and screaming and bellowing all the way to the end when there's really nothing you can do about it. So just try to find a way to coexist.
And over time, that probably will be worked out as the upshot of all that. And Ed Bangs, again, the former federal wolf recovery coordinator, did point out in your story that the wolves are here to stay, that no matter what Montana policymakers do, what ranchers or wolf lovers do, the wolf is a very persistent animal and knows how to survive.
Yeah, there's a reason we feel so strongly about them, and it's because they are. I mean, if you want to talk apex predators, there's very few creatures that are as cunning and as smart and as adaptable as a wolf. And Ed Bangs, Doug Smith, you know, almost everybody, Bob Ream, who used to be with Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, almost everybody I talked to said that wolves are never going to get wiped off the landscape again. And I know that that's something that people bring up a lot, saying, you know, that Montana's wolf hunt is too aggressive, or that the Montana state legislature wants to get rid of wolves. And there's, when you look at Yellowstone National Park, when you look at the Bob Marshall Wilderness, a lot of these big federal lands, that wilderness lands that wolves live in, even if the Montana state legislature went off the deep end at one point and said, we're going to poison wolves, we're going to do whatever we can to get rid of them, there's still those federal lands where that's not going to fly. Like I said, wolves are, they're just adaptable and prolific. They reproduce quite a bit. So very recently, I think it was in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, they had a wolf derby where they offered people to come in and try to kill as many wolves as you can. And there was a lot of news reports about that. There was national news reports about that.
They didn't get any, correct?
No, they didn't kill any. And that's the thing that you don't hear on the other side. And so I think it is really important that people understand that yes, Montana sold, you know, 16,000 wolf tags or whatever it was, but the number of wolves that were actually killed, and this was, I believe, 2012, was like 225. So the success rate is so small just because these animals are really, really, really smart. You know, maybe, is it maybe too aggressive? Well, that's for some people to debate, but I think that it's important to kind of keep those things in mind as people kind of form their opinions on it.
Well, it's a fascinating story that you've done, Nate, because it does touch all the bases, I think, of the wolf debate, which is a complex debate, as many of these high-profile debates are. And I have been speaking with Nate Rott, who is a reporter for National Public Radio, and he, along with photographer David Gilkey, have a story that they've done recently and a wonderful slideshow to go with the story about the wolf debate in Montana. Nate, thank you so much for taking us behind the scenes of your story.
Thank you so much, Sally, and thank you for the kind words. It means a lot coming from you because you've been covering this for a lot longer than I have.
We won't go into how much longer. Thanks, Nate.
Thank you, Sally.
You can find Nate Rott's wolf story online by going to npr.org/wolves.
Now for tonight's forecast. There is a wind chill warning in effect across our listening area tonight. That wind chill warning lasts until 5 a.m. tomorrow for areas west of the Divide. In central and southwestern Montana, the wind chill warning is in effect until 10 p.m. this evening. West of the Divide tonight will be mostly clear with lows 19 below to 26 below zero. Tomorrow calls for mostly sunny skies with highs in the single digits. In central Montana tonight, look for partly cloudy skies with a slight chance of flurries. Expect lows 20 below to 30 below zero. Tomorrow should be partly cloudy with highs 0 to 5 degrees above. And in southwest Montana tonight, it should be partly cloudy with lows 20 below to 30 below 0. Tomorrow calls for partly cloudy skies with a slight chance of flurries. Highs should be 0 to 5 degrees above. And now for the editorial comments of Dina Mansour.
In today's Missoulian, reporter Martin Kidston tells the story of Ngo Ha, a Vietnamese professional currently in the U.S. on a Department of State program. Ha is here in Missoula this week to explore ways to enhance her work to economically empower marginalized populations. Embracing our shocking negative temperatures, despite coming from Hanoi's mild winter, she is equally invigorated by the tremendous creativity she has shared with Missoula leaders in nonprofit and governmental organizations. While in Missoula, Ha has shared experiences with representatives from such organizations as Watson's Children's Center, the American Association of University Women, and the ACLU. Ha's work in Missoula specifically builds on experiences shared since 2012 between YWCA Missoula and multiple non-governmental organizations in Vietnam. This relationship resulted in the travel of four staff members of the YWCA to Vietnam and Cambodia through a Mansfield Center program funded by the State Department. YWCA Missoula's support has enabled Ha and her colleagues to take the secret second thrift store model and adapt it for Vietnam, calling it Sweet Seconds. This mutually beneficial partnership is an excellent example of how the Mansfield Center works to support the people of Montana in gaining tools for different perspectives in their work. The Mansfield Center is an academic unit of the University of Montana with a mission to serve communities throughout the state. While we are housed on UM campus, all program funds are procured from external funders. These external funds will have paid for the travel of more than 100 Montanans to Asia from 2012 through 2014. Countless more Montanans have been exposed to international partnerships, seminars, and conferences here at home. Our programs engage kindergartners through professionals at the peak of their careers. One of our centerpiece programs is the Economic Empowerment Fellows Program. Funded by the Department of State, 28 professionals from Burma, Cambodia, Laos, Thailand, and Vietnam will travel to Montana for a 2 to 3 week fellowship with Montanans in shared professions. Montana and Asia partners learn together, augmenting their critical skills in such areas as entrepreneurship, marketing, business development, and private-public partnerships. President of the Kalispell Chamber of Commerce, Joe Unterreiner, had this to say about hosting a fellow from Laos. "This was a special opportunity to learn about a wonderful country and how they manage their business advocacy through their Chamber of Commerce. In the chamber profession, we are increasingly called upon to assist businesses navigate in an international and export environment. This exchange has helped me and my organization improve our ability to do that in Northwest Montana." As Montanans become increasingly engaged in the global economy, the Economic Empowerment Fellows Program promotes mutual understanding and lasting partnerships while building a global network of professionals able to work more effectively in an increasingly interconnected environment. My colleague Kelsey Stamm and I just returned from travel to Southeast Asia, where we personally interviewed top candidates from more than 300 applications. Consider these dynamic professionals we chose to come to Montana this year. Vietnamese fellow Ms. Tran is a manager at Hanoi's Bao Viet Insurance Corporation. She hopes for a placement at an insurance company or a bank to learn more about the balance between profitability and a commitment to providing insurance to underserved populations. Thai fellow Ms. Orna Nong is the marketing director for a coffee business. She seeks to refine her skills so as to better empower indigenous women to engage in coffee production and quality control. Lao fellow, Mr. Suvanalat, provides business training services to nascent businesses and nonprofit organizations. He looks forward to building his skills in planning and development so that he can better advise his clients. Cambodian fellow, Mr. Chun, is the owner of an ecotourism company looking to learn from comparable tour companies here in Montana so as to share customer service and growth strategies. Our namesake, Senator Mike Mansfield, once said, "Knowledge is essential for acceptance and understanding. By examining the political heritage, the economic experience, and even the national myths that tie people together, by exploring the cultural, religious, and social forces that have molded a nation, we can begin to better understand each other and contribute to the knowledge and understanding that will strengthen our ties of friendship and lead to a better world." In working together toward Mike Mansfield's vision, we encourage you to join us through the Economic Empowerment Fellows Program. For more information, please see our website at www.umt.edu/Mansfield. On behalf of the Maureen and Mike Mansfield Center, I'm Dina Mansour.
Dina Mansour is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.